Bienvenue, bonsoir, en compagnie de China Miéville qui nous fait le plaisir et l'honneur d'être parmi nous pendant une petite heure. Ça va donc durer une heure. On va essayer de faire 45 minutes d'interview et on laissera donc 15 petites minutes pour vous, pour que vous puissiez poser des questions. Donc n'hésitez pas, d'autant plus que China Miéville me confiait lui-même tout à l'heure qu'il aimait particulièrement ça, que ça l'intéressait véritablement de communiquer avec vous pour savoir un petit peu ce que vous pensiez de ces bouquins. Et donc ça se passera en fin de conférence. N'hésitez pas. Je peux vous le dire, il ne mange pas, il est plutôt gentil même. Voilà. Pour ceux qui ont des problèmes de compréhension, vous avez tous des petits appareils magnifiques qui vont vous permettre de comprendre ce que va dire China Miéville. Il parle très bien français, mais peut-être pas assez bien pour faire sa conférence.
Non, ça c'est pas vrai. C'est très difficile pour moi. Et je veux dire que je suis désolé, mais c'est très difficile pour moi à parler en français. Et donc, je vais parler en anglais parce que je veux penser au sujet des questions, pas au sujet de la langue. Et donc, please forgive me.
C'est tout pardonné. Donc, vous avez compris, vous avez ces dispositifs qui sont là, qui vous permettront de passer de l'anglais au français comme vous voudrez. Ce qui me permet d'ailleurs de remercier les interprètes qui sont ici, dans cette petite cage en verre, on ne les voit pas, ils sont cachés, mais ils font un super boulot depuis le début du festival, et ils vont continuer à le faire. Donc, merci beaucoup, et puis d'avance, excusez-nous, on parle très vite. China Miéville, merci d'être avec nous, merci d'être venu nous voir à Nantes. J'ai envie de commencer par vous dire félicitations. Félicitations pour ce prix Hugo que vous avez obtenu ex aequo avec Paolo Bacigalupi pour le livre The City and the City. Alors, The City and the City n'est pas encore malheureusement disponible en France. Il sera disponible a priori début 2011 aux éditions Fleuve Noir, qui édite l'intégralité des romans de China Miéville, en tout cas catégorisés adultes. Sachez également qu'il existe un livre qui s'appelle L'Ombre, qui lui est publié au Diable Vauvert. Qu'est-ce que ça change, China Miéville, d'avoir un prix Hugo enfin ? Parce que vous avez été sur la shortlist plusieurs fois, et ça y est, enfin vous l'avez. Est-ce que ça fait un vrai changement, ou est-ce que vous continuez tel que vous êtes normalement?
It was very moving, but I didn't. I have to say, I didn't really think of it as last at last, because that would imply that there was some kind of that one assumed one was going to get it at a certain point, which was genuinely not the case. But it's a prize that if you're into science fiction and fantasy, you grow up reading books with Hugo on the cover, and this is. Very, very moving to be in that position oneself. It's an odd situation because, as you say, it was a tie, which is very rare with the Hugo. It's happened, I think, 3 times in 60 years or something. But I prefer to think of it as a quantum Hugo, and that Paolo Bacigalupi and I oscillate between Hugo particle and wave form this year. So it's properly science fictional.
Et justement, puisque nous ne pouvons pas encore lire ce livre, sauf si on lit l'anglais, auquel cas on a de la chance, mais si on ne parle que le français, si on ne lit que le français, c'est pas possible pour l'instant. Est-ce que vous pouvez nous présenter ce roman de City and the City? Qu'est-ce que c'est? De quoi ça parle, à peu près? Donnez-nous envie, en quelque sorte.
I'm not a salesperson. It was my attempt to be very faithful to the protocols of the crime genre, particularly police procedural, with a kind of noir sensibility. And to that extent, it's somewhat different from some of my other books because it is written in a less baroque prose style, I suppose. And it was an effort to triangulate between a crime novel and a novel of the fantastic in a tradition inspired by writers like Bruno Schulz and Alfred Kubin and Kafka. So it is, I hope, a kind of oscillation between those two styles. It's a murder mystery set in a pair of cities that exist in a very unusual relationship with each other. And part of my hope is that the pleasure of the book, I hope, is uncovering the nature of that relationship over the course of several chapters. So I would rather not say too much more about it, because I'd rather people... It came to it fresh.
Ah, vous êtes
but it's very good. It's brilliant. You know, you'll like it.
Vous êtes un excellent vendeur, en fait. Hein, donc, un bouquin génial. On va adorer. Alors, on termine avec ce qui n'est pas encore sorti en français, avec donc Kraken, qui vient de sortir dans le monde anglo-saxon. Kraken, pareil, très rapidement. Qu'est-ce que c'est? De quoi ça parle?
Kraken is about the theft of a giant squid from the British the Natural History Museum in London. Ever since I was very young, I was very interested in cephalopods, octopuses, squid, cuttlefish, and there is a giant squid in a tank in the museum in London. And this is true; this exists. And I went to see it, and I had a moment of imagining as the guide was opening the door that what if we opened the door and the tank wasn't there? You know, wouldn't that be a bummer? That would be really sad. And so I thought, well, what if someone stole the squid? How would you do that? So that's the peg, and then it becomes a kind of very chaotic, hopefully engagingly ill-disciplined book about faith and magic in London. It's a kind of apocalypse comedy. It's a comedy about the end of the world. Well, several ends of the world.
Ah, quand même. Est-ce qu'on a le droit d'y voir une petite référence à Jules Verne ou pas du tout?
Well, kind of, but Verne is, I mean, really for me one of, you know, many, many writers in a cephalopodic tradition. As much a reference to Victor Hugo and H.G. Wells and H.P. Lovecraft and, you know, the whole... I was going to say subterranean, but I should really say submarine tradition of cephalopod literature. This is my attempt to be part of that tradition.
Alors, si on fait maintenant un grand écart et qu'on repart en arrière, votre premier roman, qui n'a pas été le premier publié en France, s'appelle King Rat, donc le roi des rats. Il est paru il y a quelque temps, toujours au Fleuve Noir. Le premier roman publié en France, ça a été Perdido Street Station. Qui vraiment vous a imposé comme un auteur important outre-Manche et ici dans l'Hexagone. Qu'est-ce qui différencie le China Mieville de maintenant, de The City and the City, et le China Mieville de King Rat? Qu'est-ce qui s'est passé entre-temps?
I think King Rat... Perdido Street Station was a book that came very much out of a kind of... swelling of confidence, because after King Rat there was this great joy that anyone wanted to publish a book that I'd written, and so Perdido Street Station was a book I'd been writing for a long time, and I became very kind of exuberant about throwing everything in. It's a very full book, I think, and the people who like it like that about it, and the people who don't like it don't like that about it, but I think City in the City feels very different to me, but I try to sort of change the voice from each book to each book. So although the difference is probably more marked between the City in the City and the other books, I feel like the voice is somewhat different between Perdido Street Station and The Scar, and particularly with Iron Council, there was a big change again. So I think it's a process of sort of constant development. Hopefully, as you write more, you get better. But the paradox is that getting better also makes you more self-critical. So in some ways, it becomes harder. So you look back at stuff you wrote earlier, and you know, you're still proud of it and you love it, but you look at it and you wince a little bit and you think, oh, I wouldn't do that like that now. You know. So I think it's that kind of development. And hopefully, the getting harder never gets in the way of getting better as well. That's the aspiration. And it is, I think... You're very lucky if you have, as I think I do on the whole, readers who are open to you experimenting a little with book to book, so that you have a kind of relationship of trust whereby people may say, even if I don't love this book as much as this one, I like the fact that you're not necessarily doing the same thing every time, and over the course of a few years this will make for a more interesting shape. So that's my aspiration.
Bah, ça donne quand même envie aussi. Je ne sais pas si le public ici a lu tout China Mieville, mais en tout cas, je vous y invite. Tout est là, sinon, donc précipitez-vous. Perdido Street Station, c'était, vous le disiez, donc un roman exubérant avec énormément de choses. Vous avez utilisé tout à l'heure le terme baroque. Je pense que ça peut s'appliquer à ce roman. Vous avez utilisé le même univers avec un livre qui n'est pas vraiment une suite, mais qui reprend tout ce que vous aviez développé dans Perdido Street Station. C'est The Scar, les scarifiés en français. Donc ça veut dire que vous n'aviez pas tout dit alors avec Perdido Street Station. Vous aviez envie d'y revenir encore.
Well, the setting of those three books, the Perdido, the Scar, and Iron Council, is a single world. But as you say, it's not a series. I wanted very much to make each book a standalone, and you can read them in any order. And the attempt is to put in a few little presents, like little Easter eggs for people who do read all of them. So there are references in one that you will only get if you've read the others and so on. But it's not necessary. It's not intrinsic to any kind of overarching plot. And yes, I mean, I could constantly go back to that world, but I think it's quite important to me not to default to going back to that world, because I feel like one of the things that we do all the time in geek culture is we destroy the things we love by failing to leave them alone. And we go back and we go back and we go back and we ruin them by auto-cannibalizing the stuff we like. And I mean, for me, the biggest example of this is the bad logic of Boba Fett in the Star Wars movies, that, you know, everyone knows Boba Fett was the best thing in the first three Star Wars movies, and so there's this kind of imbecilic geek logic that we all have, which is, if X amount of Boba Fett is cool, two times Boba Fett, two times X, will be two times as cool. This is completely wrong. In fact, it halves the cool of Boba Fett, and then when you have him in a third time, it thirds the cool of Boba Fett, and so on. So I very much don't want to undermine what I like about the world of Baslag. I would far rather write too few books than too many in that setting. So I would only write another one, which I would like to do when when it demands to be in that setting, as opposed to simply defaulting to be in that setting.
Vous écrivez maintenant totalement à plein temps.
I do. I've been able to write full-time since Perdida Street Station, which is not something you take for granted. So I've been very lucky.
Alors, l'idée de détruire ce qu'on aime, c'est une idée intéressante et assez radicale en science-fiction. Vous citez parmi vos influences un auteur comme M. John Harrison. Il y en a évidemment d'autres. On pense à Lovecraft, vous parlez de Ballard, évidemment Mervyn Peake, qui est un auteur absolument formidable, très très connu outre-Manche, malheureusement finalement peu connu du grand public en France. Hein. Vous pouvez d'ailleurs certainement trouver ses livres ici. C'est assez extraordinaire ce qu'a fait Mervyn Peake. Et vous avez fait en quelque sorte vous-même, vous faites partie, vous avez lancé un mouvement que vous avez baptisé New Weird. Donc c'est, vous vous qualifiez en quelque sorte de, vous avez fait de la weird fantasy, donc de la fantasy bizarre, hein, je vous le laisse en VO. Et qu'est-ce que c'est que cette New Weird? Qu'est-ce que ça apporte justement de plus? J'imagine qu'il y a forcément un rapport avec la New Wave qui avait été lancée par Moorcock et Ballard. Je vois que vous souriez, je pense que la question a dû vous être posée des dizaines de fois, mais peut-être pas forcément en France.
That is true. Well, you put me in a difficult position because a few years ago I wrote an article saying I'm not going to talk about New Weird anymore. So I now either have to become a liar or let me try and square this circle by meta talking about New Weird or talking about New Weird. I did not invent the term. I did not launch the movement. I think it was invented by M. John Harrison, who you mentioned, talking about my writing and a couple of other writers. I think you put your finger on it. If I was going to point at a couple of direct influences, it would be something between the New Worlds writing of Michael Moorcock, the journal New Worlds in the 1970s, and the weird fiction tradition of H.P. Lovecraft and Clark Ashton Smith and William Hope Hodgson in the 1920s. And essentially it was about, blurring boundaries and, glissement between, the science fiction and fantasy and supernatural horror, a certain kind of social engagement, an abjuring of the notion of escapism and so on. The thing, quite quickly, I mean, I think there was a very short window in which it was useful to talk about it, because my feeling is any time there is a literary movement or moment or manifesto or anything like that, a manifesto is a performance, it's a provocation, it's a kind of swaggering and a game, and that's what it's for. And hopefully it can also become a useful heuristic with which to make sense of some things going on in the world, but those two aspects are not distinguished. What it is not and can never be is a scientific analysis like geology or botany or whatever. And so I got very frustrated because people who were critical of the idea of New Weird would often say one of two things. One was, you mentioned this writer as New Weird, but actually if you look at this book that they did 20 years ago, it's not exactly the same as all the rules you said for New Weird, so there's obviously no New Weird. And I was like, oh, come on, who cares? Honestly, this is totally not the point. And the other thing was people who would say, oh, why do we have to have labels all the time? Why can't we just have good fiction and bad fiction? Which is a kind of simpering that really gets on my nerves. And I felt because human beings are taxonomic animals. We taxonomize all the time. We categorize. It's how we think. It's useful. Plus which, any discussion of a manifesto is a flirtation and a battle. And the first thing you have to do is get the name right. A New Weird was a fantastic name. We kicked ass with that name. Problem is, almost immediately, commodification kicks in, and within a year, it becomes a marketing term. And marketers start saying on the back of books, great new weird book. Now, I'm not having a go at marketers. They have a job to do. They have, and they are part of my industry. But it's not my job. And the point, I think, at which anything, and this happens not just, I mean, this happened in music, it happens in art, it happens in fiction. The point at which a category which has been aesthetically interesting and provocative becomes a marketing category, I think is the category at which it's probably most helpful to say, I'm not talking about this anymore. I don't repudiate anything, but I don't think I have anything useful to say using this term anymore. So that's what happened quite quickly with New Weird.
Alors, on n'avait pas lu l'article en question, donc on ne savait pas. Mais
Well, there's the pricey now. You don't need to now. Yes,
ça va, parfait. Donc, vous avez bien compris. On arrête avec New Weird tout de suite. Pour finir, pour continuer, vous avez aussi... alors, c'est pas vraiment une étiquette, mais c'est une sorte de réputation d'un auteur un peu politique. Et vous avez un engagement vous-même qui est assez fort politique en Angleterre. C'est quelque chose d'assez européen, par exemple, quand on regarde la science-fiction, parce qu'au sens large, anglaise au sens aussi large, je parle des Écossais, là, des Irlandais et des autres, on a effectivement une vraie dimension politique qu'on ne trouve pas forcément outre-Atlantique. Comment vous voyez maintenant, est-ce que vous voyez une réelle différence entre la science-fiction, disons, anglaise, pour faire large, et la science-fiction américaine, autre que politique, ou est-ce que ce schisme politique c'est finalement la chose la plus caractéristique entre ces deux courants?
There are certain clichés. There is a cliché that American science fiction is right-wing and British science fiction is left-wing. I think this is fallacious. For a start, the great majority of science fiction on both sides of the Atlantic, I can't speak about France, I don't know enough about the scene, but in both sides of the Anglo-American Atlantic, is at least consciously not very political at all, one way or the other. Now, of course, anything which thinks of itself as apolitical is almost certainly extremely political, in a sort of disingenuous way. But the other thing is that, in fact, it's not true that there's no progressive and left-wing tradition within science fiction in the U.S. There's some fantastic radical writers within the U.S. tradition, and one thinks of Ursula Le Guin, jumping straight into the mind. Eric Flint is a very left-wing writer. I mean, there's plenty we can talk about. What I think is true is that in the States, the political culture of science fiction is contested. The default political culture of science fiction community within Britain is what I would call sort of liberal, left-liberal. In the States, there is a very strong, what you would call a libertarian wing, kind of right-wing, free-market libertarian, and then there is a liberal and a left-liberal wing. So that, I think, is more of the difference between the two. I would also want to say, and it's an obvious thing to say, but one doesn't choose the fiction one loves because of its embedded politics. I mean, H.P. Lovecraft was... a bilious and disgusting racist and anti-Semite, and this is intrinsic to his work. It is possible to admire the work and despise the politics that goes into it. Gene Wolfe, who I think is one of the outstanding literary geniuses of our field in the 20th century and indeed now, is a right-wing Catholic. I am not, but I think his books are outstanding. And conversely, there are writers with whom I'm much more politically simpatico, and whose books I have a bit of a hard time with. All of which said, I am interested in the political hinterland of books and sort of doing a kind of political understanding and reading of books, whether they think of themselves as explicitly political or not. And for myself, I have no problem with defining myself as a political writer, because I think it would be disingenuous of me to deny that the textures that I'm interested in putting into my books are informed by my politics, which are socialist politics. I don't think they're reducible. I don't think that, you know, if I want to make a political argument, I will simply do so. I won't smuggle it into a fantasy novel. It would be a very inefficient mode of propaganda. But they are informed by each other to some extent. I think that is true.
Mais alors, ça veut dire qu'en fait, vous l'avez d'ailleurs dit, vous l'avez dit vous-même, vous l'avez déclaré à plusieurs reprises, vous ne faites pas de livres politiques. En fait, vous faites de la fantasy, pour faire large. Et vous dites précisément que voilà, on ne va pas faire les choses en cachette et introduire ces notions-là discrètement dans un roman donc de fantasy. Est-ce que vous avez déjà été tenté d'écrire, cette fois de prendre cette idée à contre-pied et d'écrire, pour une fois, un réel, vrai roman politique ? Est-ce que ça ne vous intéresse pas du tout ?
Si
je peux me permettre, il y a une vraie référence dans ce domaine en Angleterre. On pense bien sûr à George Orwell, qui a fait ça, et son 1984, entre autres.
I certainly don't mean to suggest that I don't think my books are political. I think they are saturated with politics. I think they are not driven by the desire to make political points. I think in most cases they are driven by the desire to create a world, to tell a story, to invent some really interesting monsters, but I think it would be facile of me to suggest that they were not political. And it varies from book to book. So, you know, for example, in my fourth book, Iron Council is a book about trade union politics, about a general strike, and inspired very much by the Paris Commune of 1871, and about an urban insurrection. It's very directly a political book. It's a book in which the narrative is informed by politics. But it is also, and has to be, a narrative. It has to be that somebody who has no particular interest in or sympathy for the Paris Commune will still find it an exciting story. And I think you can have it both ways. You know, I don't think that's a problem there. And I think The City and the City is a very political book. It's a book about the nature of juridical borders, of national cultures, of taboos, and the psychology of taboos, that sort of thing. I think there's an enormous amount of politics there. There is a line for me at which books which are written to make political points, I may really admire the politics, but I may also not really enjoy them as novels. And it's interesting, you know, 1984 is never a book I have been in love with. You know, Animal Farm I loved until I realized it was an allegory for the Russian Revolution, at which point, you know, when I thought it was about talking animals, I was all over it. But then I started... So there is a line at which... one of the few things I have ever agreed with Tolkien about is he has a phrase where he says, I have a cordial dislike for allegory. And I too have a cordial dislike for allegory, because I like fiction that believes in itself. And my point is that I think you can have it both ways. I do think my books are political, but I don't think they're allegorical, and I think I hope that the politics does not come at the expense of a narrative and of an affect and an emotional tenor.
Ce qu'on est, évidemment, infuse dans notre littérature, donc ce qu'on pense aussi politiquement, ce qu'on vit, forcément, et là je reprends Marx, l'homme dépend de son environnement. En l'occurrence, vous avez une enfance particulière, vous aviez deux parents hippies, vous êtes parti très jeune au Caire, et j'ai lu aussi que le Caire, cette espèce de mégapole monstrueuse, vous a inspiré justement New Crobuzon, la ville de la nouvelle Crobuzon, donc on trouve dans Perdido Street Station, ça vous confirmez?
That is true. Cairo, New Crobuzon, which is the city, is a coagulum of many cities in the real world and many cities as reflected through fiction, of which London is undoubtedly the largest. But Cairo is an important element. There's also a bit of Havana in there, a little bit of New York, a lot of cities of the imagination by people like Michael Moorcock and so on, a lot of invented cities. Not very much Paris, I'm afraid, not very much Nantes. I wasn't particularly... The French urban tradition has not been one in which... that has resonated particularly loud within my soul. I don't know why. I'm not making any... attacks, but it was never something that, except in the history. When I started reading about Paris in the 19th century, then it changed a bit. But that was too late. That was after. When I came to Walter Benjamin after I came to New Crobuzon for the first time. And then Walter Benjamin kind of appears a little bit in the third book.
Et alors, du coup, ça me donne envie de parler des villes anglaises, donc Londres, et notamment, donc, là, on peut peut-être revenir à Kinghrat, où les égouts tiennent un rôle très important. C'est parce que le monde souterrain, finalement, est plus intéressant que le monde réel.
Well, there's a long tradition within fantastic literature of, you know, what is below the ground, literally and metaphorically. You know, also for me, the advantage of the sewers is not just that it is the advantage of the sewers. There's a phrase I must try and reuse. The advantage of the sewers is not just that it is below the ground, but that it is literally full of shit. It's full of refuse, and I like the culture of the discard, the thrown away, the rubbish, and in various books this comes up, and in On London, the children's book, it's very prominent, this idea of sort of insurgent rubbish. Yes, but that notion of the city below is one that has resonated for many writers for a very long time, I think.
La ville, évidemment, on a beaucoup d'auteurs qui utilisent la ville comme un personnage à part entière. Je pense notamment à Borges. J'ai en lisant donc à droite à gauche des interventions de vous, donc on revient un peu aux influences. On parlait de Pic ou autre. Je vous ai jamais entendu parler de Borges. C'est un auteur que vous avez lu ou au contraire qu'il vous le reste à découvrir?
So are we talking about Borges?
Yeah, Borges. Oh, yes, yes,
sorry,
Borges,
sorry,
oui.
Sorry, I was confused about that. Yes.
On pourrait le faire avec l'accent espagnol, mais ça serait très ridicule. Donc, okay.
Borges is a very big influence on me. In fact, my the short story collection I have, which I don't think is which is not in French. There is a novella at the end of that called The Taine. Which is directly inspired by Borges. There's a passage from the Dictionary of Imaginary Beings where he talks about a race of animals that live within mirrors, and that is the peg for that story. So Borges, and there's certain stories that I come back to again and again. There's a Borges story called Pierre Ménard, author of the Don Quixote, which is a story that. Was a hand grenade going off in my head, and every time, you know, periodically I find myself going back to that story again and again and again. And there is, I think, I mean, possibly somebody in the audience knows, I don't know, there is a, in the, is it Document, the journal that Bataille put out?
Oh, yeah.
There is an article that is signed, one article, by somebody called Pierre Ménard, and I've never been able to work out whether this was a real person or whether Borges was referring to that or whatever, but yes, so Borges does haunt me as he haunts a lot of writers, I think.
Vous venez de me poser une colle, je ne sais pas si Borges, je ne sais pas, on va dire, a rencontré Bataille, mais ça serait effectivement intéressant de vérifier tout ça. Ce rapport que vous avez avec justement toutes ces influences littéraires donne un côté extrêmement dense à votre œuvre. Vous le disiez tout à l'heure, les gens qui aiment justement les œuvres denses adoraient ce que vous faisiez, et puis ceux qui justement sont pas plutôt dans ce, n'aiment pas tellement ça, et bien détestaient ce que vous faisiez. Vous avez conscience quand même de débouler dans un paysage assez calme avec des livres qui sont vraiment radicaux, qui sont flamboyants. Enfin, vous avez une place à part dans le paysage de la science-fiction au sens large mondial. Ça, c'est quelque chose dont vous avez confiance ou dont vous fichez perdument ou vous continuez juste à écrire ce qui vous plaît?
I think often writers are the worst people to be aware of. What it is they are doing. I mean, I can talk about the stuff I'm trying to do, and I can talk about the stuff that interests me. But there is something that gets me very impatient, which is when writers, for example, respond to critics and criticism and interpretation of their work by saying, "No, that is not what I meant." And I always think, why would I care what you meant? I mean, that's the least interesting thing about your book I can possibly imagine. And if I want to be rigorous, I have to follow that through with myself as well. So I don't think that in any way I have any kind of monopoly on insight into the stuff I'm doing. I'm happy if people think the books are radical and interesting and so on, of course, but I don't think, it's by no means unusual to be interested in texturing the worlds you create with a kind of palimpsest of references and so on. One can think about writers, Pynchon does this all the time, And one of the ways in which there is a kind of literary crossover with pulp culture and with geek culture is that those of us within geek culture are voracious archivists. There is a fantastic sense of the history of the field, which is one of the things I think that distinguishes a mainstream readership from a genre readership, which is that you can put in a little one-line reference and a disproportionate number of your readers will know that you're talking about a particular short story that was written in 1946, which itself was a riff off something, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. This can become a rather nerdy hall of mirrors, but at the same time, it can also create a really exciting sense of a kind of millefeuille of texts, and all texts are kind of built up like that. So I'm evading your question because I don't think I'm the right person to say, this is what I'm doing with the text. But certainly that kind of thinking of layering is what gets me excited as a writer, yes, and as a reader as well. I like it in the books I read as well.
Alors, justement, que lisez-vous, Janine Mieville? Bon, la réponse peut être très longue. C'est un risque.
Well, I try and keep it short because largely I think that the things I read are entirely predictable. I think one of the things that's a bit depressing as you get older is you start to realize quite how constructed by culture you are and how little there is that's surprising about you at any point. So if I sort of said, I bet everyone here can guess the kind of things that I read, and if you can say Philip K. Dick and Michael Moorcock and H.P. Lovecraft and Pamela Zimmer, and the list will be really, really obvious. So to me, and correct, you're correct, all of those instincts you have are absolutely right. What I think is interesting is that there are sometimes books that are maybe less intuitive, and all writers have this. There's, what's interesting is, the book that a writer is obsessed with that you wouldn't necessarily guess. So there are, there is a huge, enormous wad of literature that I'm quite sure is very, very obvious. And then there's a few books that have impacted me that surprise me, and therefore, may surprise others. So, for example, Jane Eyre by Charlotte Bronte is probably the book that I find myself returning to again and again. There's a Zimbabwean writer called Dambudza Marachera who is not in any way a genre writer, but I find myself reading again and again with great passion and joy. Certain children's books, Beatrix Potter, I don't know if she's big at all in Britain, in France, but the Beatrix Potter books I find terrifying, and the tale of Jeremy Fisher is by far the most frightening subaquatic monster story there's ever been. So those would be a few titles that would be less obvious, I think. I mean, I can sit and list the obvious ones if you want, but I don't think anyone would be surprised.
Bon, on espère la liste, on l'attend d'ailleurs. Peut-être que demain on l'aura. Pour finir, avant de passer aux questions, parce que je vois que l'heure tourne et qu'il va nous rester un petit peu un quart d'heure, vous êtes un auteur extrêmement visuel. Vous avez un style qui appelle au dépaysement, c'est un peu banal de dire ça, mais c'est néanmoins assez vrai. Et je me demandais justement quel était votre rapport à l'image. On verrait très bien Chaina Mieville en bande dessinée. On verrait très bien Chaina Mieville adaptée au cinéma, pourquoi pas. Qu'est-ce que vous pensez de l'image, justement? Vous en méfiez en tant qu'auteur ou au contraire, vous l'adorez parce qu'elle fait aussi partie de cette pop culture que vous évoquiez tout à l'heure?
I think it's partly a generational thing, is that, I grew up with movies obviously looming very large, but I am increasingly uninterested in films. I mean, the majority of films I see, I'm very disappointed with. So while I'm not in any way opposed in principle to somebody adapting any of my books. And I think, you know, the phrase is that we are in negotiations, we're in discussion about a few of the books, and I would be, you know, happy in principle. I'm skeptical about, whether or not it would be, you know, a particularly good job, because statistically the chances are bad that it would be any good. And the other thing is there is this lamentable notion that the teleology of any piece of fiction is to become a film. Like, you know, when a book grows up, if it's very, very lucky, it will become a film. I mean, this is a bizarre notion. I mean, I'm quite happy with the books as books, and if they ever turn into films, they will be a different thing. And in fact, they will lose as much as they gain. I mean, obviously, I will gain some money, which is nice, but what will also be lost, for example, is the lack of foreclosure, so that New Crobuzon is never pictured, and that means that it is a collaboration between me and every reader. Every reader has a different image of New Crobuzon. The moment that becomes ossified into celluloid, that is lost, no matter how much one might wish it to be otherwise. Similarly, if in a less dramatic way with graphic novels and with comics. Where I do draw a great deal of inspiration is from visual art. I was very into paintings. I mean, I draw myself, but I'm not really, you know, a professional artist. But I, you know, the surrealists in particular, the visual art of the surrealists, Wilfredo Lam and Yves Tanguy and Max Ernst and people like that were very influential on me. And comic strips, as you know, I grew up with art and stuff. So those, I feel those dynamics coming into the writing from a kind of mulch of inspiration, rather than the other way around being something that I would aspire them to be in the end. But you're quite right. I mean, I think visually, and many, many scenes I will spend a lot of time without actually typing, just literally sitting there like a zombie, seeing it in my head and then transcribing what I see.
Merci beaucoup pour ça, China Mieville. J'espère que ça vous a donné envie de vous précipiter à la librairie et d'acheter ces livres par palette entière. Hein, essayez d'en acheter plusieurs exemplaires à chaque fois. La parole maintenant, c'est à vous, puisque voilà, on a China Mieville avec nous pendant 10 minutes. Vous avez une dame à côté qui a un micro. N'hésitez pas à poser vos questions, parce que voilà, je vous le disais au début, China Mieville est assez motivée par entendre ce que vous avez à dire. Monsieur.
Vous n'avez pas beaucoup parlé de son roman L'Ombre. C'est pour quel public, quel univers, à quel univers se rattache-t-il?
The book was written for younger readers. It was written because I read a lot of fiction for children and for younger readers, and I became aware of the fact that no matter how much I love a book now, if I read a book now and I think it's absolutely the best thing in the world, it never impacts me the same way that a book did, which I read when I was 8, that I loved. And the way a book can become a permanent part of somebody's mental furniture when they're a child, I found very sort of affecting, and I wanted to, I suppose, try and tap into that particular way of absolutely intense reading that I don't think you ever get among adults. And then I wanted also very much to pay homage to the fiction that had been formative for me as a child. Above all, Alice in Wonderland and Lewis Carroll. I say Alice in Wonderland, really I mean Alice Through the Looking Glass. This is one of the great schisms of modern times, is Wonderland versus Looking Glass, and I'm on the Looking Glass side of the equation. So it's a homage to Alice. It's a kind of post-industrial Alice. And then, you know, wanting to play some games with ideas of fate and all that. But it was written primarily for younger readers, with the aspiration that, you know, adults could also obviously enjoy it, just as I enjoy reading books for younger readers. But it was written with a younger readership in mind.
Merci. Une autre question? Parce que si personne n'en a, moi j'en ai, hein, donc on peut continuer comme ça longtemps. Une petite question peut-être sur ce que vous êtes en train de faire maintenant. Vous travaillez sur quoi précisément maintenant, en ce moment?
I'll be very disappointing on this question. I mean, there is a book coming out next year called
Embassy. Vous reposez.
I wish. There's a book coming out next year called Embassy Town, which is done, which is a science fiction novel. And I'm working on two novels at the moment, but I won't talk about them because I get very superstitious. I feel like it's asking for trouble to discuss a book that's in process. It just feels arrogant in the face of the contingency of the universe. So I am writing, but let's leave it at that. And drawing as well.
On pourrait imaginer peut-être un roman pour la jeunesse illustré par China Mieville aussi.
My lips are very sealed. What can I say?
D'accord.
Bien. One could imagine it, indeed. You know.
Ouais, ça s'appelle une réponse. Donc là, vous avez un scoop. Est-ce que parmi le public, une autre question? Voilà, monsieur.
Bonjour. Alors, moi, j'aurais une question. C'est pas pour vous donner une étiquette, mais pour une sensibilité, parce que c'est vrai que dans vos univers, c'est tout à fait particulier. C'est très difficile de retrouver ça ailleurs. Mais moi, je voudrais savoir ce que vous pensez si on dit que, par exemple, la Nouvelle Crobuzon, c'est un univers steampunk. Alors, pour ceux qui ne connaissent pas le steampunk, c'est une ambiance un peu décrépite du 19e siècle, à la fois très futuriste, très moderniste. Et je voudrais savoir ce que vous en pensez, vous.
Steampunk, I didn't hear in French. Is it steampunk?
Steampunk, c'est parfait.
D'accord. The steampunk was a label that was applied to the New Crobuzon books by other people. I never said I have written a great steampunk epic, but people have called them that. And I have no problem with that. I think, on the whole, I am not particularly fussed by what people want to call the books. All genres and subgenres are fuzzy sets. They're all imprecise. So because a lot of the books revolve around steam-level technology, people call them steampunk. Okay, fine. You know, I do think I have a bit of a problem these days with much steampunk because I think it has become somewhat of a cliche, and much as zombies and vampires have become cliche, so I think steampunk has become a cliche. And I think also any time, literary movement becomes a very default cliche thing, one needs to ask oneself the question politically: what is going on here? You know, what is happening culturally that this is the way dominant voices are dreaming in our culture? And for me, I have felt for some time that a lot of steampunk is an exoneration of the empire. There is a kind of reboot dreaming of 19th century with even more stampy power, and the colonized voice is completely effaced. Now, I'm by no means the only person to say this. In fact, there is a debate going on online at the moment among writers like Charles Stross and Nisi Shawl, who are making these points very vociferously and, I think, very impressively. Obviously, one doesn't think that it can't be reclaimed. Any genre can be reclaimed. Any genre can be messed with and argued with. But I think that we have reached a point where, at the moment, the default aesthetic within steampunk, I think, is a rather sclerotic, tired, and reactionary one.
Voilà, ça s'appelle une réponse assez exhaustive. D'autres questions encore? Il nous reste quelques petites minutes, enfin deux, trois, donc vous avez encore le temps.
On a beaucoup parlé des villes comme personnages intégrants à vos ouvrages, mais est-ce que vous ne considérez pas, au fur et à mesure de vos ouvrages, que les faits politiques eux-mêmes, je pense notamment dans The City and the City, deviennent de plus en plus des personnages et des actions à part entière? Est-ce que c'est conscient ou est-ce que c'est venu naturellement dans le processus d'écrire?
Well, I think The City and the City, particularly perhaps, there is a certain kind of actualized political metaphor in that book, which I would accept. I'm afraid the question of, is it conscious, is a question I find it impossible to answer, because, when one's writing, everything one does is conscious, and at the same time, everything is written just because that's how feels best at the time. I realize this sounds very evasive, and I apologize. I think you do put your finger on something which I would agree with, which is that it is, the notion of the city as a character in and of itself is a rather empty notion. I mean, it's fine as far as it goes, but it doesn't really tell you that much, because there are many different ways of considering what a city is. So it's not just a question of the city as a character. It's like, well, what character? What kind of character? What exactly is this character doing? What is being done to this character, and by whom? So from that level, I suppose there is a sort of intrinsic politicization to the notion of treating the setting as character. I don't know if that answers your question at all, but certainly it's the way I would tend to approach the issue.
Allez, il nous reste 30 secondes pour une dernière question, et après, après Jane Mayville va devoir partir pour dédicacer ses livres. Pas de questions, alors tant pis. Merci beaucoup, Jane Mayville. Je vous rappelle donc.
Merci très bien, tout le monde.
Je vous rappelle que ces livres donc sont accessibles et lisibles à côté à la librairie et que lui-même part tout de suite les dédicacer. Donc, en même temps, je dis ça, je dis rien, mais vous pouvez y aller. Je remercie beaucoup les deux interprètes qui sont cachés là-bas toujours, qui n'ont pas bougé, qui ont fait un super boulot, surtout avec un accent anglais parfois à couper au couteau. Merci beaucoup, messieurs. Et la suite, tout de suite, après donc ceci.